speaker is an active civil rights lawyer and a bar member in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. He has more than 33 years' experience as a lawyer in both domestic and international areas. He has what I consider to be a brilliant idea to use the Data Quality Act as a framework for bringing requests for correction against the National Institute for Standards and Technology in light of the consideration that its conclusions were contradicted by its own evidence. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jerry Liebhardt.
Let me get started just by doing some radio fill, since I know that we have a radio audience, but it's going to take a few minutes probably to get the laptop set up so that I can start the slideshow part of this presentation. So while we do this this technical part, maybe one of the things that we can do for our radio audience is to provide them with a little more information about who we are here this afternoon. I know from this morning I was impressed with David von Kleist's use of the survey technique with the audience. He asked us questions, and we gave him answers. So I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to tell you a few things about me. But in return, I'm going to expect a little bit of information about you. All right? Now, how many here present this afternoon have at one time or another worked in corporate America only to leave in a huff or otherwise get fired? I see one. Oh, it's going to take a while to count this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. The hands keep coming up. 13. It's nothing to be ashamed of. So that tells me a little bit about who might be drawn to a presentation like this. People who find it a little bit difficult to go along with the norm or with the standard explanation of events. It's not an easy thing to do. The norm is to go along, to get along. You start raising questions about 9/11, and then chances are that someone in your family or someone who has a significant relationship with you might tell you not to do that. And they might tell you not to do that for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that they might consider themselves to be in danger. You know, someone might say to you, what are you trying to do, get me killed? Because the implications of 9/11 are quite clear. This is not going to go over anyone's head. It's an instantaneous recognition that if you raise questions about this, particularly if you link the events of 9/11 to the use of high-tech weaponry, of which there are only two sources. One is the military apparatus of the United States that comes under and within a strict chain of command. And then there's the other one that comes under the auspices of the military-industrial complex that is not even within the strict control of the military chain of command. After all, the generals do not manufacture high-tech weapons. point of view and a legal perspective, is to take this issue of the involvement of the military-industrial complex from the general to the very specific. In other words, we are at the point in developing the legal approach to this issue of naming names and inviting them under compulsion to come into court and to answer some questions that we might have. And it is my honor as an attorney to work with the lady, the researcher, the scientist, the person who just preceded me at this podium. Dr. Judy Wood is a client. And Dr. Judy Wood has taken the presentation that you just heard and has put that presentation into the form of a legal request. Actually, she's put it into the form of two legal requests, one of which depends on or results from the other. And she's not alone. Another researcher and thinker has done the same thing, Dr. Morgan Reynolds, who you will hear from in detail tomorrow morning. And he, too, has utilized this two-step legal process, which I will seek to describe and also seek to input into the slide presentation that I'm going to try to implement. Now, as we do this process, let me start by giving you an explanation of the two legal approaches that we have used. The one is called a process of requesting corrections under what is called the Data Quality Act. The Data Quality Act is of relatively recent vintage. It dates from the year 2000, and it was actually it actually results from industry wanting a way to limit their exposure to governmental regulation. And the Data Quality Act was added in as a rider or as a throw-in to just simply the budget bill that was passed in the year 2000. The Data Quality Act has three paragraphs. It's very general. And all it does is indicate that anyone who has any dealings or involvement with any governmental agency that issues either reports or issues regulations or goes through a process of reporting on data must do so in a way that adheres to certain defined quality standards. The reason that industry had in mind for the Data Quality Act was to make sure that they had a way of either contesting or calling into question regulations when they were promulgated. So, as many of you know, the task of reporting on what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center was given over to an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce called the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. Okay? And it took NIST from 2002, when it was given this task, until the end of 2000.
People Radio Network from 4 to 6 people.
That's hot. I'm sorry.
The slide presentation. Unlike the magnum opus that Judy just presented, mine is more in the way of word slides. After all, that's what the lawyers principally do, is, we do work with words. And as a matter of fact, speaking with some of you during some of the breaks, I know that there's a desire among many to increase the interactivity that we are having in this well-attended conference. So I'm going to take up that suggestion, and as a matter of fact, this is not being done as a favor to you. I have a request. I have a request for assistance. I'm going to tell you why. The process of requesting or utilizing the Data Quality Act means that you submit to NIST requests for corrections. In other words, you say to them, the data that you have presented is inaccurate, and here's why, so correct it. So, what we have done with Dr. Wood and Dr. Reynolds' work is we have said, here are examples of data that are readily available, that are clear on their face, that in your report on what caused the destruction of the Twin Towers, you did not take into consideration. And as you have seen with respect to Dr. Wood's work, and as you will see with respect to Dr. Reynolds' work, that's a considerable amount of data. Now, it's fair and accurate to say that the report that NIST issued on the destruction of the Twin Towers left out virtually each and every element of evidence that Judy Wood just presented over the course of the last 3 hours. Not one element of that evidence did NIST go near, okay, much less explain. And as a matter of fact, although it was NIST's task to explain what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center, they didn't do that. They said that that was the question or the objective of the report, but then they went through a process that said, you know what, all we really have to do is to tell you what happened from the point that the supposed jetliners crashed into the buildings up to that point where it looked like they were going to begin to come down, and then everything that happened after that point was inevitable, period, end, that story, stop the report. And that's it. And that is what they did. So, everything from the lathering process to the speed of the destruction to the absence of any appreciable debris pile to the appearance of steel being turned to dust and of concrete rebar and everything else being pulverized to the appearance of cylindrical and perpendicular and regularly shaped holes, to the appearance of toasted cars and vehicles, incongruent distances away from the World Trade Center site? None of it was explained or touched upon by NIST, and Judy Wood said so, and requested that NIST retract the whole darn thing and do it again, only this time do it without the use of the services of the MIC, if you would please. NIST, like most governmental agencies, relies upon contractors to do certain of its work. Well, alright, who should be a prime contractor for doing an investigation of the destruction of a building? Well, that's an easy answer. No, you go to the companies that specialize in PSYOPs and in the development of directed energy weapons. Because that is who they use. Survey question.
Fill out the name.
How about SAIC? And how about ARA? How many of you know of these companies?
What did it stand for?
I see a couple of hands, 3, 4, 5. I see people see if anyone else is going to raise their hands, and then they all start raising their hands. Okay. Yes, I'm going to answer the question that was presented. What does SAIC stand for? SAIC stands for Science Applications International Corp. They are based in San Diego. Among the work on their recent resume is that they were given the contract to take over media in Iraq after the invasion of Iraq in order to make sure that the media presented stories that were to the liking of the powers that be. However, SAIC in the event failed in that endeavor and undertaking and just simply did not get it right. So they actually lost that contract. One of their key specialties is that of the development and carrying out of psychological operations. That is what they do. And as we have seen from speaker after speaker today, starting with Jim Fetzer's overall presentation, going on into David von Kleist's very compelling presentation, followed by the presentation of Dr. Wood and of Barbara Honecker, as well as Bob Petrakis and Kevin Barrett. We have all seen how, from beginning to end, and on a continuing basis, 9/11 is quintessentially a psychological operation. And it was carried out on the basis, in all probability, based on what the evidence appears to suggest, and what the evidence confirms, the use of high-tech weaponry. Now, let me say that I picked up on a phrase that was used earlier today by Barbara Honecker, and that word, or actually two words, one was soft evidence and the other was hard evidence. And I actually, there's a third approach that is actually central to the work that I'm doing with Judy Wood and with Morgan Reynolds. And that word is admissible evidence in the context of what goes on in court and legal conviction that the photograph is an accurate depiction of what it claims to show. And a great deal of care and attention is being done and has been done by Wood and Reynolds to make sure that the photographic and video information and evidence that is important to their claims can be used as evidence. Okay. Now, with the Data Quality Act, once you submit this request for correction, you can do so from a variety of perspectives, and one of the main reasons why the request for correction was submitted by these two researchers was actually to pave the way for another kind of action, a kind of action that is based upon or stems from what's called the False Claims Act. And under the False Claims Act, individual people can bring lawsuits on behalf of the United States government. Yes, someone said the name of these cases out there in the audience, and they are known as QI-TAM cases. Okay, how many of you have some familiarity with the QI-TAM process? Okay. Now, and that's a few of you, and I will try to give a brief overview of the QI-TAM process. I can start by telling you that the QI-TAM process is used, I would say, probably most often in connection with the healthcare field and Medicare claims, Medicare fraud claims. Basically, the essence of a QI-TAM action is that it says that the U.S. government, basically as a customer, has been defrauded by someone who did business with the U.S. government or who received money from the U.S. government. And if the person who brings this claim, who is referred to as the relator, is successful, then the money paid to that contractor, whoever it might have been, is clawed back, and that contractor also has to pay a stiff penalty, usually in the form of a they are clapping because we did manage to get the slide show up and running. No, I'm not for sure I'm going to show it. Okay. I wasn't quite sure how I'm going to title this presentation, and so that's why we have basically an opening slide that is just an old photograph that I took of a partial lunar eclipse with an insert of a planet that happened to be in conjunction with the moon at the time that this photograph was taken. However, this is a composite because the planet didn't come out right in the actual photo that I took. And so what that was intended to suggest or show is that, I came to this work by way of a varied background. There was a time when I was a pretty active amateur astronomer. There was a time when I was, pretty fairly well self-taught in philosophy and in metaphysics. And there was a time when, going back to the 1970s, when I happened upon information concerning directed energy weapons, which were then in their relative infancy, although even then they were not new. And even then, there were serious concerns being raised about ratified, it takes on the effect of law and has the same force and effect as a as what you call a statute or a law of the United States, and is just as binding. Well, actually, it's space law, and it is a specialty of international law. It arises primarily under the auspices of the United Nations Treaty. The United Nations has a committee on the peaceful uses of outer space that is a major committee of the United Nations, albeit one that most of us don't have much involvement with. However, it's an important UN committee, I think, because of both the importance and the sensitivity, as well as the overall complexity of the technology involved. In the early years, in the 1960s, 1970s, there was a significant interplay between the developed and the undeveloped, or the developed and the so-called third world countries of the world, centering on the concept of technology transfer and of making sure that the less developed countries in the world were not left out of the process of space exploration and of the use of space technology. That issue still sort of simmers on the back burner, but at present the primary issue, I think, has become that of weaponization. Okay? Alright, so the issue with respect to the use of QTAM cases is that you as an individual, if you have information that that monies have been paid to or collected by a contractor on the basis of either fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, then you can go through the process of bringing a QTAM action. However, in order for a QTAM case to get very far, you are very quickly going to run into an obstacle that is called the original source doctrine. Okay? And that's how the Data Quality Act comes into play. Here you have Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds saying something. What are they saying? They are saying that the NIST report is false and fraudulent, using those words, false and fraudulent. Who prepared the NIST report? Well, if you look at the NIST website, it lists all of the contractors who were involved. And not only does it list the contractors by name, but it lists the contractors by the name and by the name of the persons who worked for the contractor who were assigned to the NIST project. Guess which two companies had by far the most people assigned to the NIST project? ARA and SAIC.
What's ARA?
ARA is Applied Research Associates, located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with hardened test facilities all over the place, and with principal headquarters probably right around the block from a joint military organization, or JTO, known as the Directed Energy Directorate.
You might mention that SAIC is the ninth replace their lack of faith. Over $6 billion a year.
Okay, Dr. Morgan Reynolds said that I might mention that SAIC is annually within the top 10 of Defense Department and of U.S. governmental contractors, despite having relatively few employees, less than 6,000. And I might add, Morgan, that of the employees that SAIC has, it has more employees with top and high governmental security clearance classifications than any other company on the planet.
Reverse the initials.
And reverse the initials. That's right. And AIA almost certainly comes in second in that respect. Now, I'm going to skip through some of these slides and we'll come back to them. I want to have you take a look at this one. How many of you have heard of the Directed Energy Professional Society? Okay, there are a few. All right. Well, here is a slide that shows you how the Directed Energy Professional Society, which, by the way, only dates from the year 2000 or 1999, somewhere in there. But there came a point in time when a number of companies thought that there should be a Directed Energy Professional Society. And among the
founders,
I have one of those laser pointers. what I just pointed to says silver level founding sponsor of the Directed Energy Professional Society. And the first named company there is Applied Research Associates, Inc. Okay? Now, the Directed Energy Professional Society has a rather comprehensive website, and I commend it to you. They have a series of PDF booklets dating from the year 2000, but stopping after the year 2002, that contain some very interesting articles. In fact, the one from 2000, I highly commend to you, because I'm going to paraphrase what the first article of the Directed Energy Professional Society's booklet entitled Wavefront says. And it basically says lasers here, lasers there, lasers everywhere. And basically, the language of the article essentially admits that there are directed energy weapons in the form of high energy or particle beam weapons in space, that they are deployed in the high Earth atmosphere, that they are deployed on platforms at the mid-level atmosphere, that they are employed or deployed on platforms at low altitude, that they are deployed on platforms that operate on the ground, and that they are deployed on platforms that operate at sea. That's what I mean by lasers here, lasers there, lasers everywhere.
And in satellites.
That's quite correct. In satellites in low Earth orbit, in satellites in high Earth orbit, and probably in satellites in geostationary orbit, and maybe at the Lagrange point. So that's what we are here confronted with, that they're there, and there's a direct interface. In fact, I consider the Directed Energy Professional Society list of sponsors to be sort of a Rosetta Stone, telling you if you want to know who are the key members of the military-industrial complex, well, look at the sponsors of the Directed Energy Professional Society, which you can find on their website, and that is who they are.
And Shiva at Livermore is the razor for heart.
That's correct. And there are, now, what we, I'll give you an anecdote here. You know, from a legal point of view, if you have a question that you need answered, why, you go to the people who you have reason to believe have the expertise to know how to answer your question. So, do you remember Judy Wood's Butler slide? The one showing World Trade Center Tower 1 turning to dust? You know, in mirror, the different shades of dust and the, you know, the vague outline of the building and of its structural steel components just sort of turn to dust. You know? Well, why not send that photograph off to the Directed Energy Directorate? They are, after all, governmental employees that work for us. And ask them, dear madam, and it is the madam who runs the Directed Energy Directorate. Her name is Susan Boynton. What do you say? Greetings, Susan Boynton, how are you? Attached, please find photograph of the destructive process associated with the World Trade Center. Please review this photograph and at your convenience, please let us know if the effects seen are consistent with the destructive process that would be expected from the use of directed energy weapons. Thank you.
And Homeland Security will be after you the rest of your life.
And what you say in the letter, in the next paragraph, is that we seek only information in the public domain. If you are a person who might be covered by CFR 32 CFR Part 154, which is the part dealing with how you get, and more importantly, how you can lose your security classification if you have one. And you can lose it as a drop of the hat. You know, you talk about people, ordinary citizens, having lost their freedom. But put yourself into the position of someone who has a security classification. You know, talk about not having any freedom. Now, Dave von Kleist went so far as to, you know, ask the person here who has that clearance to identify themselves. But Dave, they can't do that. If they identify themselves, they will probably lose their security classification. If they lose their security classification, they lose their job. It's as simple as that. So that is that's a very, you know, serious thing. So we say, look, we know that just writing you this letter is a dicey thing. You know, because we're basically asking you to admit that the military-industrial complex pulled 9/11. We're not naive, and we would be silly to pretend otherwise. This is not a joke in doing this. And, you know, we don't expect, yes, it was, and this is the name of the device that was used, and the serial numbers of the parts in it are pursuant to the list. We don't expect that, but this is done in all seriousness, but it has to be thought through, and it has to be thought through to the level of making requests have a right to make through the procedures that you have the right to use in the places where you have the right to use them. And if you get an answer, fine. If you don't get an answer, you've done what you could. Now, we fully expected to get an answer. We went on to say, and as a matter of fact, we've sent a copy of this letter to Clay Johnson III, because Clay Johnson III is probably the third most powerful person in the apparatus of the U.S. government, and the most powerful person in the apparatus of the U.S. government who you are likely not ever to have heard of. But he heads the security apparatus of the U.S. government. If you got a clearance, you got to go through Clay Johnson. And Clay Johnson is one of Bush's lifelong, best, closest, and dearest friends, who comes from Texas, and has been with Bush forever. And that's who Clay Johnson is. So you send a copy, you know, to Clay Johnson, because you're not trying to get these people in trouble. But you are also seeking to be very clear that you are serious in your request. And you want to know. So you get a reply from the Directed Energy Directorate that does not say yes, but guess what? It doesn't say no. It does not treat your request as though it's frivolous. It acknowledges it's serious. It says it's very you raised a very interesting question, blah blah blah. So and so, we don't have the budget, blah blah blah. So and so, to help you right now, if we could, we blah blah blah. So and so, and that's what it says. And that's what you'd expect it to say. But what you do not expect it to say is, how dare you ask this question? You don't expect that, because you have a right to ask that question. You don't expect it to say, your question is frivolous, because it's not frivolous, because the evidence speaks for itself. And if you have a better explanation for Butler, then give it. If you are of the mind that Butler could be caused by the combination of a supposed impact by a hollow aluminum tube jetliner, big though it may be, it's still hollow, it's still aluminum, and steel is still steel, and kerosene is still kerosene, and gravity is still gravity, and those forces, similarly or in combination one with the other, in any mixture and in any order, is simply insufficient to have caused the level, the degree, and the totality of destruction that we saw and can present. So, the Directed Energy Directorate has indicated that it would be available for further inquiry and for further discussion from Dr. Judy Ward that would be requested. And we would have expected no less. Okay? Now, what this tells you is that if the hypothesis that the apparatus of the U.S. government has been taken over by forces who are responsive to no one, then the ordinary citizens and people who work for U.S. governmental agencies at any but the highest levels are probably no different than anyone assembled here this afternoon and or listening to us on the radio. They are as concerned concerned as you are. They don't know what to do any more than any of us as individuals know what to do. But there is a good chance that many of them, if not almost all of them, would be as willing to be of assistance in the process of getting ourselves relieved or liberated from that which has taken us over as any of us are. The only issue is that it's their livelihood. And so, you know, they can't do things in a precipitous way, and it wouldn't work anyway. They just get fired or have an accident. Okay? Because the problem that we confront is on that order of magnitude. It's too big for any one of us. But it is not too big for all of us working together. Now, here's where I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to indicate to you a little bit about ARA with this slide. This is from one of their most recent newsletters. And the part of it that jumps out is in the first two paragraphs on the left-hand side. And I'm going to read them into the record, so to speak. This is ARA's Concept Development Group, and it says about them, "The mission of the Concept Development Group is to develop hardware for munitions applications, including warheads and fuses and related technology. This includes design, development, testing, and initial production." Doesn't say, and then it's turned over. Their focus is on developing advanced or unusual weapons concepts and designs that expand performance ranges in terms of survivability, penetration depth, range, and lethality. They are working with major aerospace companies to develop such devices. Well, how on earth did they become a NIST contractor with that kind of development and expertise? Group members possess a large number of core ARA skills: penetration mechanics, hydrocode analysis and development, finite development analysis, fuse development, and lethality and weapons effects analysis. They also have a very strong test capability to conduct development and qualifications testing. Test engineers work closely with engineers at the primary weapons test sites at White Sands Missile Range, the Energetic Materials Research and Testing Center, and others. A lot of others, probably. So, that's who assisted NIST in the development of the report on what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center. Now, I told you that I was going to need your help, okay? Well, on July 27th, NIST issued its reply to Dr. Wood's request for correction. And unlike me on the internet, they didn't begin their reply by saying, Jimmy Wood has that wacky theory. Okay? I'm going to assume that no one here is naive and that you all know that Dr. Wood has a list of critics, detractors, and opponents a mile long who appear to have a great deal of time to devote to telling you exactly why Dr. Wood's work is wrong and no good, and that the words that you often hear about her are not very kind, and I don't see any reason to repeat them here, other than to give you the anecdote that every time they try to put Dr. Wood's work on Wikipedia, it gets taken down. Okay? Well, that's not how NIST responded to Judy Wood on July 27th, which I didn't see until July 30th. This was a busy week, so I hadn't really had a chance to go through this reply that Dr. Wood has received. And so I'm going to invite you to go through it with me. Give me your impression. Okay? So for starters, they don't start out by saying, "Dear Wacky Judy." They say, "Dear Dr. Wood." And that's all it is, it should be. All we did is ask them to retract that report that they submitted because it was false and fraudulent. So what else did you expect them to say other than, "Dear Dr. Wood"?
The doctor's thoughts on Carter.
As well.
For more information, call 1-877.
Explain me what they saw in her. In one instance, what appears after the blacked out section was a sentence that stated in substance that was a military operation. Before it was a section that talked about cars exploding for no reason. Then a long section that was blacked out. So we thought NIST might need to know about this. And in the request for correction, we said, "You know what, NIST, and you need to access the unredacted statement. You can do it. You have the power to do that." Okay? All right. So just so you know, that's what one of the supplements said. The other names, including these initial companies. ARNFAIC. This goes on to say, quote, "In your letters, you challenge the premises and the probable cause sequence proposed by NIST in NC Star 1, explaining the sequence of events leading up to the collapse of the World Trade Center towers." So you see, NIST is telling you, just as I said, they never described what happened. And they're telling you that in their letter, aren't they? They're confirming that what we said they did is what they did. They're only saying they proposed a probable collapse sequence. In other words, in my view, NIST is telling you, yes, we did not determine what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center. Rather, we propose a, quote, probable collapse sequence, unquote. And by putting it in quotes, give me some feedback here. This is what I asked for. What does this mean to you?
Well, I think I'm acknowledging the skepticism of by including that event. I think that if you admitted that both events sound bad,
Here's what we're going to do. It's important that this feedback reach our radio audience. So, if you have something that you'd like to say about either this paragraph or any of the subsequent ones, come on up here, or get in line, and make your comments into the microphone, if you don't mind. Okay? Got a couple people coming forward. And feel free to either state your name or not state your name and give your comments.
I'm there to announce Tom Baker's case of CYA. And in case they're covering their ass. And they're using the language to do it.
My name is Lynn Monroe. I'm a whistleblower at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab, and I know all about the big laser there. My question is, in the Department of Energy report on the Yucca Mountain project, which was total science fraud, all of their reports start out with a disclaimer that DOE is not responsible for anything in the report, which means they don't even believe their own reports. My question is, did the NIST report have that disclaimer?
Thank you, Lauren. The NIST report did have a couple of disclaimers, and the one that I recall best is the disclaimer that the report that they did would come under the more strict requirements of the Data Quality Act that have to do with reports that are prepared on the basis of scientific rigor. They wanted their report not to be judged or determined on that basis. A second disclaimer that is contained in the NIST report is a disclaimer that is to the effect that nothing in the NIST report can be used in any legal proceeding for any purpose.
I'm Don Stahl, and I would just like to point out that the quoted phrase, probable collapse sequence, that's not by itself and none of the context so far, does either indicate where or what is being quoted, whether it's Judy Woods' letter or NIST's own report. So I think that materially affects what whoever the writer of this reply from NIST is intending at this point.
It could be left intentionally vague. What I can tell you, however, is that the quoted phrase probable collapse sequence is one that was adopted in the NIST report and relied upon. In other words, they started out by saying that the objective was to determine what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center, but they changed that and ultimately only gave a, quote, probable collapse sequence that they proposed. And to offer a proposal based upon a probable, with the use of the concept probable, which is a further condition. That's a condition that stakes out a claim that is less than a comprehensive explanation. Okay, so it's a conditioning phrase, a phrase of limitation, or one might say an artful dodge, or one could say that's fraud.
Guilty demeanor.
Okay. Now.
Another comment.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is John Munter, and I'm from Northern Minnesota. And my opinion is the NIST idea could not possibly be called probable, and it could not be possibly be called a collapse. And so it would be fraudulent from that standpoint.
Okay, let's continue with the next sentence. Let's see how that works. Okay, yeah. As an alternative, you assert in your letters that, quote, the evidence confirms that the World Trade Centers were felled by use of directed energy weaponry. So that tells you that Dr. Wood went at them directly, clearly, without doubt, without equivocation. Did you know that? Okay. So in other words, Judy Wood had enough confidence in the convincing nature of the information that she had come up with to put it on the line in an official request for correction. Now, here's where it gets interesting. They go on to acknowledge in that middle paragraph that, quote, in addition, you assert that Applied Research Associates, a NIST WTC investigation contractor, had a conflict of interest in performing work for the WTC investigation because ARA is a significant manufacturer of directed energy weapons or components thereof. Okay? NIST, to their credit, grasped what Junior was saying. Because you know what? That is what she said. Alright. Now, NIST goes on to say, for the reasons presented below, NIST is denying your request for correction and does not plan to retract the NC Style 1 report as you have requested. Again, they grasp the nature of the request that had been made. To facilitate communication, the term, quote, collapse, unquote, as used in this letter, and in NC Style 1, means a falling in, loss of shape, or reduction to flattened form or level of a structure. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have to double check that. I'm not sure NC Style 1 said that. So, as a matter of fact, I have to think through this as to, this seems to be a material change from what NC Style 1 said. As a matter of fact, if they had defined collapse that way in NC Style 1, I think there might have been a greater sense on Dr. Wood's part that they at least understood what had happened. And I'm pretty sure that you will not find that definition of collapse in NC Style 1, but as I said, this is new. And so, you know, we have 30 days to decide whether or not we're going to appeal this decision and take it further, and also to determine what the basis of the appeal will be. And it's too soon to know that right now. This is hot off the press. Okay. Now, they go on to say in this paragraph, quote, as stated in NC Style 1, NIST only investigated the factors leading to the initiation of the collapses of the WTC towers, not the collapses themselves. Well, I told you that. So, you see, they acknowledge that what we say they did in their report is what they did. Okay? Come on up.
I'm not qualified to understand, I guess, sort of the structure of these types of documents, but I just remember Nixon and a number of other politicians saying that when someone asks you a question that you don't want to answer, then you answer the question that you wish they had asked. Okay? And so in this letter, they seem to go into extraordinary detail explaining verbatim exactly what Judy would ask them. that strikes me as kind of interesting. I'm just curious to know if that's, is that standard kind of operating procedure for writing a denial letter to say, well, you said this, 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 and this, and you're wrong, but at least you said it, and they're going into, I don't know, kind of impressive detail, reflecting back what she said.
That's a good question, and my initial response to it ties into that earlier part of our discussion where I said that the people who work for the governmental agencies are no different than we are. That's, I can't know this, okay? But, my impression, using the word impression in the exact sense of, what I perceive as being communicated to Dr. Wood in this letter is, between the lines, Dr. Wood, you might be right. And that to me is stunning. I can't be certain about that. But you know what? For the time being, I think, as a lawyer, that I am going to very definitely include that possibility in the work to be done on a going forward basis. Thank you for that question. The deal is, got to come up and speak into the mic if you want to ask a question.
My experience roughly has been that people, when they want to help but they can't, they tell you exactly what you need to do in order for them to be able to help you.
Yeah.
And that long list that you skipped over of the exact law under which whatever was going on seems like Arnold Guthrie's quotated underlined section. Look in this law, this is what we have to comply with.
Thank you. You might be right. And actually, the only reason why I skipped over that part is that ARA. Now, here, NIST is specifically acknowledging the extent to which Dr. Wood's request for corrections named that name. Okay? In your supplement of March 29, 2007, you also assert that Applied Research Associates, one of the contractors involved in the investigation, has a, quote, significant, clear, and palpable conflict of interest that adversely affects the quality and the integrity of the work done by ARA for NIST, unquote. In other words, laying the foundation for what? Key TAM. Now, when we finally got the slide projector to work, you will recall that I was then in the process of explaining what the requirements of a key TAM case are, and I was on the verge of explaining what the most difficult requirement is for purposes of going forward with a key TAM case, and that requirement is that you, the relator, have to be the original source of the information. Okay? So, in other words, in Dr. Wood's case, she has to be the original source of the claim that has been submitted in some administrative form that the contractor involved did something wrong in what they did. Hello? I
think we have information here that should satisfy the original source requirement. And the original source requirement is the one that most QTAM cases flounder on. Okay? So I'm very, very pleased with this language. Quote, as a result of the analysis, ARA, prior to award, each NIST WTC investigation contractor underwent a rigorous organizational conflict of interest analysis. As a result of the analysis, ARA was determined not to have an organizational conflict of interest. In addition, each contract contained a provision requiring the contractor to notify NIST immediately should any organizational conflicts of interest arise during the course of the contract, and no such conflicts of interest were reported, unquote. Anyone want to comment on the significance of that? If so, come forward.
Jerry, can you hear me? Jerry?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Could I ask you a question about that?
Yes. Is this James?
Yes, it is.
All right, James, go ahead.
Sure. I wanted to make a note and ask a question maybe. I noticed that they, on the ARA issue, they specifically take issue with ARA manufacturing weapons, but couldn't it just be the case that ARA is a contractor to the manufacturers of the weapons? They're doing research on the weapons, and in this instance, they're probably reporting back to the directed energy weapon manufacturers what the effects of their weapons were. They're doing the applied research.
Okay, well, as a matter of fact, James, I did show a slide that talked about ARA's work, and maybe the impact of that did not come forward to the radio audience as well as it might have here with the people who saw the slide, but I think within ARA's website there is sufficient information that does tend to confirm that they are a manufacturer, both on their own website and the fact that they are a founding sponsor of Directed Energy Professional Society. Now I want to say two more things about this. One is that the person who asked this question is one who actually was one of those who initially spotted the connection between ARA, NIST, and their work on and for directed energy weapons, and that's how this movement works. Okay, that's how we make progress, being in communication one with the other. And James, I think I told you at the time that I was deeply grateful that you uncovered that information.
Sure, well, it was a pleasure to, and I was just wondering if that could have been the weasel word they were trying to get around, being a direct manufacturer as opposed to, say, working for firms like SAIC, who are the direct manufacturers.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I can tell you that, more work has to be done on uncovering exactly what, what ARA does. And hopefully, when we get these, when the subsequent cases get underway, we'll have a chance to do that. That's what would be intended.
Okay.
Thanks, James.
Thank you.
It seems that the substance of the interaction is that Judy Wood's letter alleged many and various reasons why physical laws, for example, were violated. And this replied the by NIST. And this reply to her claims that these laws were violated consists of saying, we investigated everything, and the physical aspects and the conflict of interest aspects. And if you're interested in the physical aspects, we refer you to the appendices, which I would bet are probably completely irrelevant, and simply reiterate that as far as the conflict of interest goes, we looked into that before you ever wrote to us, and we found no conflict of interest. It does not address any of her reasons. It simply says, you're wrong. It does not attempt any type of rebuttal. It simply contradicts.
Thank you for that. And I think that's correct, that it's noteworthy for making what I would call conclusory statements without giving rationale, much less reason.
I'd just say that it looks obvious that she's also given a big hint that you should request a contract to look for provisions of the contract that you might be able to find out they violated and therefore pile on additional charges. She seems to be listing conditions for you to go hunting for.
I think that's correct. And the NIST contracts some of them are available online, and some of them were during the course of the actual work done, but may not have been archived. So I'm not 100% sure about that, but I do recall at one point going down that road of taking a look at those contracts. And the what I can tell you is that the conflict of interest language is not very extensive. It's very general, from what I recall. Okay.
I'll have to agree with the wording she used about whether the study obeyed the conservation momentum, conservation of energy laws. I was addressing what happened as the building was being destroyed. The building went away faster than it could possibly fall. But if they're not looking into the building being destroyed, quite up to that point, it obeyed the conservation momentum and conservation of energy. The day before it was destroyed, it stood. And it was standing up until it was destroyed. So if they only want to be responsible for up until the moment something happened, it obeyed the laws of conservation momentum and energy.
Yeah, so there you have it. You know, just a tautology, something that was, you know, true because it was true.
I would like to go back to the start and point out that the phrase, the collapse following the plane impact, that phrase, collapse following plane impact, is ambiguous depending on the grade of English that you are working with. There could be a suggestion that the collapse occurred because of the plane impact. Or there could be, which I think is the primary sense that most people, readers and writers, would take it to have. There's also the very precise sense that one event occurred after the other, following. So the building went away after the plane hit it. That's the minimal meaning. The real operative meaning is, in that phrase, the building went away as a result of the plane collapse. And trading between those two different meanings will allow this to seem to have answered.
The answer given is very consistent with the process that we're here engaging with, and that, you know, I have the responsibility of, you know, doing more with Dr. Wood in coming days to decide on the appeal. And that the overall meaning that I think we get to this process is that we are parsing the language. That is to say, taking a look at it in context, but nonetheless on a, you know, sentence by sentence or paragraph by paragraph basis, looking for meaning, looking for admissions, looking for inconsistencies. Now, the last sentence is also one that lends itself to that very process, and that sentence states, quote, since there is no factual evidence to support this claim, NIST has no basis for accepting your proposed corrections to NC Style 1, and the factual evidence she's referring to there is the conflict of interest that ARA has and confirmation that ARA is in fact involved in the manufacture and development of directed energy weapons. That's why I showed the ARA slide. Okay? Now, let me conclude, because Jim Fetzer is standing here, so that means it's time to conclude. You see this? This is from the court site, and it lists a number, and it's which is public information, but it also says this case is under seal. So that's it. You can't talk about it until it comes out of seal. Now, Dr. Morgan Reynolds has a case. Dr. Morgan Reynolds, on behalf of the United States of America, that is to say, he's a QI-TAM relator. When you're a QI-TAM relator, that's the status that you obtain. Dr. Morgan Reynolds, on behalf of the United States of America. This can work. Alright? Versus Science Applications International Court. This is the court order entered on July 11th, 2007. Any numerologists out there? Okay. That has the effect of taking Dr. Reynolds' case out from under seal, and it is now a matter of public record as it proceeds. I thought you might like to know that. Thank you for your attention.
Sure. Very recall. Very recall, everybody.